This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, hello and welcome to Slot. We're delighted you're here tonight. My name is Shaj Matthew. I study comparative literature at Penn. Tonight, we welcome two editors from N Plus One magazine, Nikhil Saval and Marco Roth, who are here to discuss world literature, a subject that has got a lot of attention in the past decade or so, with theorists as diverse as Pascal Casanova, Franco Moretti, Emily Apter, etc., outlining what they think the best direction is for the field. And so all of these very polite scholarly arguments are great, but in the words of our third panelist, Professor Jean-Michel Rabaté, sometimes it's better to throw a brick through the window to get people's attention. And so with the publication of World's Light last August, the editors of N Plus One threw that proverbial brick. World Light is, of course, please come up front. There are two seats available.
Two seats here.
So World Light was the polemic that inspired tonight's panel, and as well as a firestorm of criticism on the web. Here's how the piece begins. World literature certainly sounds like a nice idea. A literature truly global in scope ought to enlarge readers' sympathies and explode local prejudices, releasing us from the clammy cells of provincialism to roam, in imagination, with people in faraway places and times. The aim is unimpeachable. Still, in a sick, sad world, it's hard not to be suspicious of anything as wholesome as world literature. The word literature itself has come to sound fake. Is there something the addition of world is making up for? A blemish it's trying to conceal? So to try to figure out the answer to that, we'll consult our panelists. First, Nikhil Saval, one of the authors of World Light, is an editor of N Plus One magazine. His book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, comes out this April. Welcome. He's joined by Marco Roth, who is a co-founder of N Plus One, as well as a current editor. His memoir, The Scientists, about a family riven by AIDS and other unforeseen transmissions, is now available in paperback from Picador. And finally, rounding out the panel, is Jean-Michel Rabaté, who, as many of you know, is professor of English and comparative literature at Penn, as well as a curator at Slot. So, welcome. To start us off, Nikhil, would you mind giving us a précis of the piece for people who read it all the way back in August or just haven't got a chance to read it?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. First, thank you to Slot and to Shaj for having us. This is exciting. I think this is certainly our first event at UPenn, or connected to UPenn, and maybe our first event in Philadelphia, even though Marco and I are resident here.
It's taken a while, but here we are.
It's taken a while, but figured out. So it's funny that we should call this a brick thrown through a window. I think we did hope to throw the brick through the window and run away. Unfortunately, we're being held to account for our crime. The editorial titled World Light, and really thank God we didn't call it World Republic of Losers, which was something we were floating, caused enough controversy. I co-wrote it with my colleague, Benjamin Kunkel, who is he's at N Plus One. He's a novelist, a critic, a sort of professional Marxist economist autodidact, if you read his stuff in the Lenin Review of Books, as well as N Plus One. It came out of two impulses. Mine was, I guess the background is I had N Plus One had gotten invited to several literary festivals. I don't know if you guys have been to these in your lives. They have them in Cartagena, in Jaipur, famously. And they're very, very lovely occasions. They put you up in hotels and you talk with writers, and elites fly down from Delhi and from Mexico City to Jalapa, and you perform but I also started to feel uneasy about this, the growth of these literary festivals and what effect they were having on literature and its circulation. As well as I had gotten to study the newish academic field of world literature. Ben was interested, not to speak for him, he's not here, but I think he's about right, in the increasingly elite character of the audience for literature in a global sense, and the pressure for literature to have a certain kind of literariness or a global literariness in fiction and poetry. And he wanted to investigate this as well. We were suspicious of these two things. These two impulses coincided in this monstrous, unwieldy essay that we had the unearned wherewithal to publish in this issue of this magazine, which I just bought from Penn Book Center because I ran out. I was throwing them through too many windows. Anyway, the Penn Book Center is excellent. They carry us. They support us. Anyway, plug them. We wanted to, I'll just run through this, the very long article, but if I miss something, Marco can sweep it up or Shaj can call me on it. We established that since the fall of the Soviet Union, a sort of kind of literary globalism had begun to flourish in the publishing world and in the university. Our examples were Anglophone or work successful in English translation usually, such as The Goddess of Small Things or in the academic field, Pascal Casanova's The World Republic of Letters. Indeed, along with its resurgent global capitalism, we felt that there had emerged a sphere of global literature, typified largely in the novel, which exceeded local or national boundaries, much of which aimed to reach a global audience. And we thought it was a kind of specific form to our moment. That to us seemed like a relatively uncontroversial statement. It turned out not to be. But really, the trouble starts afterwards. We had a sort of avowedly Eurocentric Anglo-American story we were trying to tell. It starts, of course, with Goethe, who had coined the term Weltliteratur to describe a kind of ethos of world literature. We should strive to produce world literature. And also Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, where world literature was a consequence of global capitalism. From the many, national literature is a world literature emerges, something like that. We went through sort of the history of literature and nationalism, but then we wanted to consider this global literature with respect to two previous moments of internationalism. One was European and Anglo-American modernism, and the other was the literature of the decolonizing world. Following the scholar critic Perry Anderson, we saw these phenomena as coming out of the uneven class development of Europe first in around just up until World War I, and then also the post-colony up until 1991, let's say, there was a persistence of an aristocracy in Europe long after it was supposed to have expired, and this nascent bourgeoisie that could not take power, and then this ever-present specter of revolution. This kind of had produced, these were the coordinates that had produced modernism, we felt, and Anderson feels. We followed this kind of to its conclusion. We felt that modernism, though it had developed out of this attempt to be very specific, very material, we think of it like titles like Ulysses, which is very located in Dublin, Wolfe's Kew Gardens, Dublin's Berlin Alexanderplatz. Weirdly, this had issued into a kind of terminus, and what had emerged in Europe since had been this literature as kind of blank, placeless allegory. Kafka was the precursor to this, but we found this emerging in more recent work as a kind of tick. And this was Javier Marias, Knausgaard, I think we noted it in Zabald, a kind of melancholia as well over this literature, like a belatedness, Michel Houellebecq to some degree. We thought that that had been the kind of fate of European modernism, was this placelessness. We then moved to the post-colonial or decolonial world, whatever term is being used now. And we talked about how this had come also out of a sort of revolutionary ferment. And this didn't matter whether the literature was on the left or the right. Naipaul and Gogi Wathiongo equally were concerned with revolution and the failure of third worldism in various countries. We thought the culmination of this movement was Salman Rushdie. Rushdie, who had started as a kind of avatar of this earlier form of world literature, Midnight's Children, is a very angry book, upset over the emergency. But the Satanic Verses, which fortuitously came out in 1988, 89, basically, culminated this moment and also pointed the way to the future. It became the first kind of global novel. The controversy of the Satanic Verses was itself important, obviously. A lot of the people who were detractors were third worldists of a certain kind, Jean Le Carré, John Berger. They accused Rushdie of betraying, the cause of third worldism. And free speech was upheld, free speech in place of third worldism in the cause of the Satanic Verses. And anyway, that became sort of the ethos of the new sphere of global literature. We then talked about how there was a kind of simultaneous politicization and depoliticization that took place after this. Like, novels were in the 90s and 2000s had to represent the globe, often in a kind of grotesque way, and as a kind of political gesture. But in a way that we found evasive. We talked about the constant deployment of trauma in the novel, in works like The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, where things that focus on contemporary life make detours to traumatic episodes in earlier moments of post-colonial life, almost as a way of evading the problems of the present. And we thought there was a material basis to this, and then I'll end there. But the material basis was basically the rise of festivals. which transacted world literature. Everyone goes to festivals, everyone has a good time. We parade before the global elites of Delhi and Mexico City and Bogota, who, you know, their money's good with us. But I mean, it's just, there was something about how world literature had developed this parallel network that was a kind of Davos-esque situation. And then also the university, which maybe we can talk about a little bit more. The university played home to a lot of writers from the decolonizing world, which is a good thing. A lot of them were refugees, like Gogi. But it also had a flattening effect, we felt like, on this literature. And this is sort of just a development. And this made a lot of this literature homogeneous, too close to post-colonial theory. In a way, it was a homogenizing thing. And we looked forward at the end to, very vaguely, to a kind of literary internationalism along the lines of the second international, of like the internationalism of the Marxist left as a kind of alternative. And we considered some novels. Anyway, that was very long, basis, but anyway.
No, sorry. Thank you so much. Now where to begin? So maybe we can talk about, you know, Marco, maybe you can get this one. One of the things you guys mentioned early on in the piece is that global literature is perhaps a better name for it than world because it takes into account the rise of global capitalism that has attended the rise of global novels. Could you speak to that, like connect those two things?
Sure. I'm here as an editor of the magazine and as somebody who was involved in the editing of this piece, but not as a writer of the piece. So, you know, it's always interesting as an editor when you work with a piece and I have... we published, in fact, on our website some of the editorial emails about this piece because this was a collective. You know, Nikhil and Ben wrote the piece, but it was published as an unsigned editorial, and we thought, well, you know, do we all believe in this? So we had to go back and forth about this, and then there were some editorial comments like. On an earlier draft, on page 4, this clause, the terrifying image of classes consigned to the dustbin seems unnecessary, somebody wrote. Maybe because I can't read the phrase consigned to the dustbin without wanting to consign that phrase to the dustbin. So that phrase probably did not get into the final version. you know, and then another editor wrote in, hi, most of this discussion way over my head, but I just want to come out in favor of the Goethe joke. It's a good joke, although I did meet someone the other day who'd read both Werther and Elective Affinities in translation, because we said that Goethe did not translate well. This was a joke. And then the production team writes in, says, the production team would like to note that we have both read Werther and Elective Affinities. And somebody else writes in, I mean to read Elective Affinities. So, you know, so much for our contention that Goethe was no good in translation, because it seems like everybody had read it. But these are the sort of things that happen in a collective editing environment. But then what we were surprised by, or what I was surprised by as an editor, is that the response seemed to be, we said very explicitly up front that world literature, which we capitalized, is different from world literature, which is to say the totality of books that are published, right, in the world, or written in the world. And what we were trying to analyze was and point to was a phenomenon which you could call the reification of world literature into something we were calling global literature or world literature, capital W, capital L, and we often use these interchangeably. And what astonished me was that most of the responses initially from readers seemed to just go completely avoid this. You know, we were attacked by a blog, for being for not writing enough about the Arab world. And then again, you know, we were attacked for using Goethe's concept of world literature, even though that seemed like a starting point for a Western-based university-style analysis of the phenomenon of world literature. Somebody was like, what did world literature mean to the Arab world in the 6th century AD? And we're like, yeah, then that's an interesting point, but we thought that we had fenced ourselves around that. And then, somebody wrote, the N plus one editors have come up with more than a hasty polemic. They've offered us a straw man called Global Lit, encompassing authors as widespread as Juno Diaz, Salman Rushdie, Teju Cole, and Kiran Desai, a woefully partial picture of world literature, and a staggeringly onerous idea of what a reader should be. By partial, they mean especially an understanding of world literature that fails to take into account the variety of world literary spaces. What counts as world literature in one place may not elsewhere. By onerous, they mean that the essay implies that a reader should slog through work she doesn't enjoy out of a misguided and pious effort at comprehensiveness. Perhaps the editors of N+1 should read more to their taste. So that, you know, like, yeah, this person actually agrees with us, but they misread our essay. And we're like, huh, that's really interesting. You know, why did they, so what was it about, and to some extent, you know, all their misreadings are productive, right? We were like, maybe we failed to sufficiently communicate the distinction between what we were calling world literature, capital W, capital L, or global lit as this reified form, you know, a kind of global style, as Nikhil was hinting in a summary, a tendency towards evasiveness and feel-goodisms of various kinds. And then, of course, actual works that are being written in places that may not make it into translation or may be seen as marginal when they do get translated. And so really, I mean, I think part of probably all of you will have questions about what we mean by world literature, but one thing I want to be clear on as an editor, and maybe I should then apologize as an editor if we fail to make it clear that world literature does not mean the totality of books written in the world, right? We're not denouncing all
just books like a Borgesian written kind of concept.
Right.
We're going to talk about all the books.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. So now I have a question for you, Jean-Michel.
Yes.
I'm going to repeat a little bit of what Nikhil mentioned in his pressy. The editors write, today's world lit is more like a Davos summit where experts, national delegates, celebrities discuss calmly and collegially between sips of bottled water the terrific problems of a humanity whose predicament they appear to have escaped. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think it's interesting to pose the question of where we speak from or engage in conversation with each other. You mentioned Penn, but this is not exactly the university. And I'm interested originally in the fact that your article could have been a scholarly article, but it's not exactly a scholarly article. And I prefer it to be a little sarcastic, aggressive, and a sort of diatribe that would not perhaps have been called academic, because we are in between those two places, and this is what I liked in S plus one, that as a certain tribune, you can discuss things differently than in academia. Of course, I am a professor, but I'm also working with Slot, and this is a slightly different kind of public of conversation. And I would like also to talk, maybe in a second moment, about N plus one and the idea of the review of the magazine. First, because I loved what I read in it, not only that piece, but many others. And also because I felt that danger of, as you said, reification, some flattening, is indeed something that we academics are often conscious of and recognize. We often defang the text that we teach. Perhaps the first remark, it's a question as well, is as I just, it's a coincidence, really, this afternoon, going to my office, I had this World Literature in Theory, and actually I ordered it as a sample, as a textbook. But this is quite a sign that what you are discussing is important today. But what interested me is that, of course, some of you may recognize the name, David Damrosch, who has been really very operative in launching all those group meetings and so on around world theory, connects it with theory. And there's also this question of world literature is combined with a certain theory of literature somehow. And this theory of literature is also a theory of history and society. Because as you mentioned, and I was very happy to see that in your essay that you both wrote with Ben, Marx was, after Goethe, the second systematic thinker of world literature. He used it in the Communist Manifesto. For Marx, it's not such a bad idea. It's like capitalism, fundamentally. And as you know, in the Communist Manifesto, Marx praises capitalism. Capitalism destroyed the old world, and the consequence is world literature. But here, it connects very well with our last show with Seung-gi Kim, because we had a discussion of this Korean artist with Derrida, and what they discussed was precisely globalization, the dangers of globalization. But fundamentally, if I have a question for you, is given the tone at the end of the article, the sort of international, do you think there is a certain hope for the resurrection of something like the fifth or seventh international?
Whichever one we're at.
We're in. Yeah. In other words, can we say, like Marx, you know, the 11th thesis on Feuerbach, that now we have to change the world, we have to stop interpreting it. Is this somehow part of your utopia, your performative utopia?
Writers have only produced global lit. The point is to change. something like that.
Exactly.
Well, comrades, I mean, yes, I think that there is a little bit of a reaching after that, towards the end of the essay, that we hope for, you know, internationalism, it's funny, I think we used it as an interpretive strategy, that we cherry-picked, in a way, authors that we liked around the globe, some of whom we had published. Juan Villoro from Mexico, Kirill Medvedev from Russia, for example, those are two authors that we published, who we felt exemplified, you know, a kind of, it's not that they were, in fact, they're not actually political in the sense that they're always writing about politics. I mean, Medvedev is, in fact, an activist, a Marxist activist, but we thought that they addressed politics with a kind of refreshing, they like Vioro had a kind of world weariness that we thought was this, we reminded us of Raymond Chandler. In fact, there was not a kind of, it was an everydayness to his politics. There was an attention to the material world. It wasn't global. It wasn't reaching after, like, it wasn't trying to compete on the plane of the globe. But it spoke to us, even though it was very much, his writing is very much about Mexico City. So that is weirdly the kind of character of the internationalism I think we were seeking. I think that, you know, you also see this, you know, some of the authors, I would now revise some of the stuff that I wrote in terms of there are some authors that we talk about as being flattened by the university. And really, actually, you find the university becoming a theme in a lot of their works. And that I think, is there's an uneasiness over their position as speaking for subaltern classes, or they don't want to do that. They know that it's wrong. I mean, this comes up in the second novel of Dinao Mengistu, who is an Ethiopian novelist, whose first novel is a kind of Naipauline novel about a shopkeeper in Washington, D.C. It's sort of about gentrification. His second novel is about a writing instructor in a classroom, which is very much like a university, but who then spins out this story of his father and the trauma he's fleeing from civil war in Ethiopia in the middle of America. And it's this self-conscious exercise. He's like, this is what my students want to hear. This is the trauma that they want to know about. Nonetheless, he still writes this story that is about trauma that's very convincing. And so in a way, there's like, I feel that even among some of the better products of world literature, Teju Cole's Open City is an example, there's a kind of involuted nature to like the it's excessively ridden by trauma, almost in a parodic way. In that sense, there's an uneasiness that I think gestures towards a different kind, different mode of writing. So I think we do see that we do hope for a kind of internationalism in that sense. That like you at least are uneasy with the way global literature is transacted, and there isn't this like obsessive reaching after global significance or trying to speak to all audiences or elites, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's another way to bring that part of the issue to make it speak a little bit to the first part of Jean-Michel, your point about these spaces that are not quite university spaces, right, that are not quite institutions, that are, you know, and genres that are not quite official genres. So, you know, one of the things that we felt strongly about when we started M+1 in 2004 is that
10 years, we can say.
Ten years ago.
Yeah.
Should we start? The planning began earlier, but that, right, this is our tenth year coming up. Is that there were genres like academic polemic that we felt were endangered. And especially if you were a young writer, it was very hard to write polemically. And we were like, well, you know, what inspired us to become intellectuals were often these polemics, right? And so what we wanted was, we were like, where could you publish such a polemic in 2004, if you remember that, which was a kind of, there were not a lot of small online magazines, very few people had blogs, very few people read blogs. There was a sense of like, well, you know, but if you also wanted to participate in a larger international cultural discourse, you had to have a magazine still, and the magazines that existed, like New York Review of Books, does not publish polemic. You know, occasionally you would get something polemical in the London Review. You know, it's hard to write for these places. You know, there's only so many slots per issue, as we've discovered. So we were like, well, you know, we need polemic as a genre, is a kind of academic polemic or sort of, you know, really engaged intellectual argument that takes risks of a kind that you wouldn't take if you were up for tenure, if you were worried about, you know, who you might offend on your next panel? Like, could you be sitting next, and Nikhil worries about, like, Nikhil could be sitting next to Dinah Mengistu, next week, or in 2 weeks. But, you take this, there had been this kind of risk averseness at the same time that there was this kind of deadening effect. So we wanted to position ourselves somewhere, is there a space that is not already taken up by an institution? And I think what we've seen with, and this speaks also to the essay, which is that as university, we know that universities are expanding. They have, there's Yale in Singapore, there's NYU in Abu Dhabi, and what this is kind of teaching a certain kind of, and Damrosch in Beijing. There's an attempt to do something like world literature as mediated by the university. And then within this, there are people who are still going to find themselves kind of out of bounds or uncomfortable within this discourse. Like, what happens to those people? So in some way, this essay kind of was speaking up for, somebody like Vioro, who's a marginal in Mexico, but doesn't have a university position here, is not going to be read. And partly, what we also like doing is we like making these kind of, evaluative gestures, and sometimes evaluative, reasoned evaluative arguments. For we think Michael Ondaatje is a bad writer. We've given you sentences to show why we think he's a bad writer. You can disagree, but then we can have a debate about Michael Ondaatje's style. Well, somebody disagreed. That was the thing. There were people who were like, we like Michael Ondaatje. Why did you criticize poor Michael Ondaatje? And we're like, if this is your idea of a good sentence, then probably we aren't going to have a great conversation about literature. But because the way that academia works now is, as we know, like, canonization has kind of replaced evaluation. So something that's, when something makes it onto the syllabus, it's seen even in some ways as tacitly being, promoted. And that's where this kind of, I feel like the kind of polemic that we try to do at N+1 is there. We exist to kind of trouble that moment of balance. But as kind of happens in this essay, you realize you can't write an essay about world literature without engaging in canonization of some kind. And I think we did, we did promote people that we, and there is a canon in this essay, that people can quarrel with.
Maybe then I could just quote the book that you probably know by a friend of ours who's been here many times, Emily Apter, who has this book, Against World Literature, that doesn't say exactly the same things you say. And I was wondering what you thought of her position, if you know her position. At least there's a chapter in her book that I find very useful on the concept of the global and the world, and she seems to be on the side of the world as opposed to the global. But also, there's the subtitle is Against Translation, or Politics of Untranslability, which poses the question of translation.
Yeah.
And as you denounce, perhaps, and this has been a very old problem in comparative literature in many countries, but at least in the US, what can we do with books that are, of course, mediated by certain translators, translations, presses, circuits of distribution, and so on? But my question would be, what is your position, let's say, if you know Emily Apter's, close to hers or rather different?
Well, we cited her at one point in the draft. Do you remember when we cited her and when
we
took
it out?
This is an interesting...
I can't remember why we didn't. Yeah, it would be good if we could reprise her position, actually. I have not read that book, but
well, maybe we can think
Ben,
more globally.
Ben is the Emily Apter specialist.
Yeah, yeah.
So you studied with Franco Moretti at Stanford, right?
Yes.
And Marco, you studied with Gayatri Spivak, right, at Columbia?
As an undergraduate.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So she's come out...
It was a long time ago.
she's come out against this sort of ecumenical global literature. She insists on reading things in the original. So we have her, Moretti, and then Apter and Casanova.
Yeah.
What do you guys think? What approach moves you the most?
I think it's clear that we know that the translation industry flows very much one way. You know, I mean, things get translated from English into other languages. Very few things get translated into English that are written globally. I mean, that's just, I mean, I don't have numbers, but, you know, you can go look it up. It works that way. I mean, that, so what that does is that creates a kind of, you know, I mean, if you write in English, you're writing in the privileged language of the globe, right? And of course that's ludicrous, because, you know, you could write in Spanish. There are millions of Spanish speakers. You could write in Arabic. You could write, you know, and I think we have this nice aside about Tagore being, like, you know, the only non-national writer to receive a Nobel Prize, because he only wrote in a language that was spoken by millions of people. And which is Bengali, right? So there is an inequality that prevails in the global translation system. I mean, that I think would be a separate piece that we would write about. You know, is it the case that you know, ideally should we all be polyglots? Yeah, I mean, we should all be, absolutely. I mean, but it's, we know that there might also just be a kind of humility in reading and translation, and I think, you know, there's something about a kind of weak international style that lends itself to, you know, and then you wonder, like, oh, you know, does Yann Martel read really well in French? Like, does he read, you know, I haven't read Life of Pi in French or in German. I mean, are there books that have, you know, and then there are writers, I mean, Borges we brought up as the kind of paradigmatic example of somebody who is a kind of world lit in the bad way that we were criticizing. And, you know, Borges, like, his syntax is supposedly more English than other Spanish writers. I mean, you know, I don't know if this is true. There might be people here who can confirm this. So, I mean, are there ways in which other writers are kind of unconsciously Englishizing themselves now, knowing that they might have a better chance? You know, these are things that are probably underneath the surface of the essay, but not in the essay.
Yeah, I mean, that's an old discussion. I mean, like, there was, like, an article in the old, new, and Stephen Owen wrote a famous article in the New Republic in the 90s about world poetry, and he had taken the Chinese poet, whose name is escaping me right now, who's part of the Misty School, why I can't remember his name, but yeah, I mean, that, and then whether they wrote to be translated. I'm not even sure that that's necessarily, that's not a bad, I mean, I like Borges. You know, like, it's not, like, necessarily a thing that, the immediate thing to discount. It's just, it seems to be part of the circulation of world literature. It's what follows from that seems important. As far as the academic question, I do think that, I mean, I think it's, it makes, I understand the scholarly impulse to learn languages, especially subaltern languages. I think I really respect that position of Spivak's. But there is a way in which comparative research, I mean, I find myself very much a Moretti partisan in that sense, that comparative research done, you know, with, it is a kind of absurd division of labor where you have this comparatist who, like, draws from all the work in the national literatures and then comes up with his theory. I mean, it produces, as Moretti would say, it produces results. I mean, like, you know, it produces, you know, like, that's, I think that's valuable. And then, you know, I have reservations about David. I mean, this is very intra-academic, I feel like, but for people this is interesting.
David, who wants the inside baseball conversation? Or raise your hand.
But just, you know, there's something about teaching world literature in a classroom where if the professor is not in command of the language, they often have students who are, and it makes the hierarchy in the classroom a little less obvious. And so, like, these, you know, this, and I've seen this in action where someone has taught a Russian text and there have been Russian speakers in the classroom, but the professor is not a Russian speaker. So I don't know. I think the translation system is definitely unequal, I think, but I don't know what my life would be without it. I think it would be a much more impoverished.
But I had the impression that you didn't criticize Borges in the piece, that you liked his position, as if he was, so I may have misread, but I had the impression that you said he's the last universal writer who can be acceptable, or no, you reject more or less his, because there's a famous text of the Argentine writer and tradition, in which he says, because we are down there in South America, we can see world literature as a whole, because we're excluded from it, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, that's my... I know I'm forgetting whose position is whose, but I think that's my...
That would be your position.
Yeah, I think this is like, you know, and there's a way in which this is... we talk about... I mean, Borges seems to be very self-conscious about it, but there's also figures like sort of familiar in that same family, like Fernando Pessoa, who we mention as sort of the most, who's constantly effacing himself and producing new identities but he seems to write a kind of world literature by accident. And we say that world literature is sort of like happiness. You might end up there, but only without meaning to. Like you need. And so in that sense, there is that, I guess we say that gesture in European modernism becomes a kind of residual gesture. It's like a tick. It's like meant to reproduce the frisson of internationalism or modernism without, but it actually has the basis in a kind of self-ratifying elite. I think that's what our goal is.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear from the audience too. Yeah. But I wanted to, because for me now, as I'm listening to this conversation, I'm like, actually, in certain ways, there's a cleavage in this essay that I'm becoming aware of.
Why didn't you fix it, Marco?
Well, right now it's too late. in which there is something like a lot of it is a polemic against what we would call like global style, mm-hmm. and I mean, and then you know, to take the Moretti quote, like what we should have done as Moretti, like as a follow up to this, is we should like put in through a computer books that we consider global lit and see if they have stylistic, you know, what are their stylistic ticks.
Yeah.
That make them global lit rather than just international, you know, the internationalist utopian literature that we're in favor of. Like, what would be the thing that, what is the stylistic klaxon that says, alert, alert, this is global lit, do not trust this. You know, rather, so that's, I think that's how I was like, maybe we should have done, you know, there's part of that, and then, or is a book that at one point belonged to internationalism, can it be taken up by the other side, by being institutionalized, or by having its author appear at too many festivals, or whatever it is.
That's true. I mean, I think that seems to be the case with magical realism. That's an Borges, you know, like there are these styles that become, that's like an obvious example of the latter, where it no longer has a motive force to it. It just becomes a gesture to signal. It signals what it used to signal, but you know, you hope for it. Anyway.
So before we take questions from the audience, do you want to talk about N+1 for a bit? You guys are now 10 years old, and you are a very angry magazine. You came out firing
magazine
against Dave Eggers. that crowd. So 10 years later, how do you? Clearly, you've made you. I think you denounced the discipline of sociology recently as well.
Oh yeah.
So
who wants to hear us talk about N+1, and who wants to ask questions? What's the audience mood? Question. Okay.
I'll ask a question. I recently read in the New York Times an interesting article about science and the creation of knowledge, and it basically was a discussion of the point that increasingly the replication of results of research was becoming increasingly difficult to do because the research was becoming more and more arcane. And so the notion of normalizing knowledge and the creation of it was becoming really difficult to maintain. But at the same time, if you think back on it, what they're talking about is almost the pushing down of deviant forms of knowledge creation. And so we have a planet, and your discussion is really reminding me more knowledge and more information than any group of people could possibly consume. But we have a platform
that is trying to rationalize it as being, this is the knowledge stuff and everything else isn't. And I'm finding the problem for me is the impossibility of keeping up with the classification process. In other words, there's so much being written. How can anybody sit around and say, well, we've identified what world literature is? You know, it would be impossible. You have so many thousands and thousands of writers. Who reads this stuff? No.
What would be the, right.
One mind can't read that all and classify it all, right? So then you have a quality control problem. You know, these are the issues that I'm thinking about.
Yeah. It's a great point. But I think, I mean, you know, that's where, you know, partly what we're, I mean, what I see the role of a magazine doing in that is not so much saying, here are the people you should read, but making a kind of polemical gesture that, you know, forces you to ask, like, oh, so, you know, there are these writers out there that I haven't, you know, and we, like, you know, here are these writers who are maybe on one side, the writers that you've heard of, and then if we can inspire that, a similar feeling of sublimity without getting people to feel like, oh my God, how can I keep up with this, but oh look, there's more out there than I thought, let me pick up this one other person and start with the one, you know, you start somewhere. So if we have an effect polemically to say, okay, if people start somewhere different or start somewhere other than where their university course on world literature told them to start, that's a good start for us. So I mean, I think the only thing that I can see us doing is kind of encouraging this sense of, oh my God, the universe is so vast and there's so many books to read, but let's at least read the ones that other people aren't reading.
But just to add to that, this is not part of the article, but in N+1, we've begun to publish the results of, there's a lot of quantitative study now to be done in literature departments. There's one, the Literary Lab out at Stanford, which is led by Franco Moretti, which mainly the results that we've published deal with 19th century novels. I mean, like, you know, we make arguments about the 19th century based on a handful of books and what we consider realism to be. And so they now can do quantitative work. It's not quite the same, but I think we do find that stuff valuable. I think that's complementary to this other research. So people are nervous about it, but I think it's great. So I just think it's exciting.
The magazine is not, there's a research branch of the magazine, but the magazine, when it circulates, its function is not necessarily to propose, you know, epistemes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not a Foucauldian revisionist group. We're an activist group as a magazine.
Yep.
Although this may be an edit, you may be witnessing an onstage editorial disagreement, which we have.
Yeah.
I think we're an activist group.
For sure.
Do you want people to use the mic, or is it okay?
Yeah. Yeah,
we can probably hear you.
We have a mic.
They might be recording. Yeah.
I can go into my brick throwing.
No, I don't actually have something critical to say, but an inquiry for you guys. About realism, so it's funny that you just mentioned it, Nikhil, but it seems like what I'm getting out of the map of world lit from the article is there are a couple branches of kind of dead modernisms, the Kafka, Borges, could see a kind of minimalist blank allegory branch that you guys see as kind of a dead end, largely in Europe, a little bit like the old literature of exhaustion argument. Mm-hmm. Then a kind of comic maximalist, Joyce to Rushdie, and magical realist branches, a little bit like the old literature of replenishment argument, but now sort of given to self-caricature and stylization. So it feels like there is a kind of argument about modernism and realism that might be kind of interesting there. So my point of curiosity is whether your literary internationalism canon, which indeed is a lot of fresh names that I, as an academic inside the world lit machine, don't know and don't read and don't teach, it's kind of an exciting list to me. But Nikhil, when you were just talking about Valoro, that's the Mexican writer, correct? Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the everyday and the material, and it sounded like a kind of a bid or a claim for realism or for branches of realisms against various kinds of dead or tepid or etiolated modernisms. So I'm just curious whether that was batted around in the editorial conversation or what you think about it now that you hear me ask the question that way, especially when you talk about internationalisms. There's an old association between Marxism and
realism.
Yeah,
and realism. Yeah.
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 Yeah, I think that's a really astute
That's a comment. Reading, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have
I think it's true that I mean, for my speaking for my absent colleague Ben, I think it's true that Ben is a believer in what he would call something like the revolutionary power of a certain kind of limited realism, and is suspicious of novels that offer you know, ecstatic sorties from things that can actually happen. I think this has been this hasn't been cashed out, but I think that's why I think your reading is very astute. I think, you know, there would be a sense of what we need in the novel is more realism, not more people on boats with tigers or, you know, multi-continental epics of the Ondaatje strike, you know, of the English Patient style, right? I mean, it seemed like you could only be a realist if you were being a historical novelist. Yeah. And so we also have a great suspicion of the historical novel that we haven't articulated fully.
You're talking about like Ghosh, Amitav Ghosh or something like that?
Well, that's an interesting, I mean, probably more the moment. I mean, well, you should talk about this. I mean, in terms of like when you talk about trauma, like what is it about the reach? What is it about trauma that makes it safe, even though you would think that it's unsafe?
Oh yeah, So I mean, yeah. So when we're not, in fact, Ghosh might be a good example of something we can. But the certain kind of historicism that we dislike or that we found problematic is, I mean, the novel of trauma is sort of like the most salient of these. And the thing about trauma is that it seems to be this, like, when you speak about it, it seems to be breaking some taboo. It's like nobody's acknowledged the trauma of slavery. So I'm going to speak about the trauma of slavery or the trauma of the atom bomb, the trauma of Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. Like these things are unspeakable, and here I'm gonna break this silence. But trauma has this kind of circularity to it, which is that just the fact that we're not speaking about something is proof that it exists, there's trauma over us. Like we're not speaking about Trujillo, so therefore that's what's causing all of this. And so it ends up, you know, a novel that I actually quite admire, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, is like there's a moment at which it moves away from the contemporary to become rooted in some irretrievable past that we cannot escape, you know, and so it's a kind, I found there's a kind of evasiveness to this. The atom bomb that kind of culminates at the end of The English Patient was another.
Well, it has a like way of stripping agency away from characters in, yes, in the present.
That's right. Right? Like, yes. It's like it's, or the most egregious example, I mean, is Jonathan Safran Foer in our example. Like it all comes back to the Holocaust, and like and there's nothing we can do about it. Like this is a kind of it's like a reaching after politics that we think is depoliticizing. Does that make sense? That seems to be the historical aspect that we criticize.
Yeah, I think as a magazine, we have a preference for we would like to see more novels in English, you know, written in native English, that deal with everyday political consequences or people's political choices, or the unconscious political choices they make, and not have it. I mean, that's something that we were kind of keep hoping for among new novelists that we don't find as much as we'd like.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Me? Yeah. Yep. I have a point of curiosity first and then a question. The point of curiosity is about Zadie Smith's essay, Two Paths for the Novel, which I found myself thinking about. And I don't think you guys talk about her. Did you talk about Zadie Smith in this piece?
No.
I mean, she sort of hovers above it a little bit, right? Mm. In the sense that she's really engaged with modernism and has plotted a kind of re-engagement with modernism as a way forward for the novel, right? Sort of Tom McCarthy as opposed to the Joseph O'Neill pattern, but is herself engaged with it in a way that's a little sometimes hard to fathom, right? The use of Howard's End and in that terrible right. campus novel. I mean, to speak of another genre that you hate, I mean, it's a bad genre, really badly done there.
Yeah.
But I do wonder how much that article and yours, how you would think of them mapping to one another and potentially against one another. The question is about the two sort of signposts in the past that you identify toward a kind of real world lit. One of them is a kind of oppositional modernism, and the other is internationalism, right? One is aesthetic in its oppositional project, one is political in its oppositional project. And I think I see why you're putting them together, but there's something a little fishy about what happens when you look at them together. When you think about the many different kinds of politics that aesthetically oppositional modernists held, many of them repellently conservative, and when you look at the array of styles, many of them not oppositional, that politically oppositional writers had, what's left is the denominator of I wouldn't even call it a style, but a stance of oppositionality. And so the piece to me sometimes feels as if it were kind of a grouse about one's, you know, formerly radical friends from college having become limousine liberals, right? And you're sort of wanting them to act like college radicals again. But again, it's less about an argued politics and less about a specific aesthetics than it is about an oppositional stance. And I wondered if you could help us see if that's really what this is about, right? If this is really about oppositionality per se, or if you have something more to say about the work that oppositionality can do as opposed to sort of ending with the performance of opposition.
Can you speak to Zadie Smith?
Yeah, I'll do. I think the short answer on Zadie is that she's someone that the magazine has kind of, there's been a kind of strange courting on both sides. And so, I like your reading of On Beauty, but for that reason, we tend to avoid saying things about her, although, and addressing her directly. Although I think you're right that probably we could have put in something about that essay again. But you know, this piece, you know, sorry to do this. This is the editorial debate first email. The good news is we have a draft. The bad news is it is even with my slashing a graph and a half and making innumerable small cuts, the piece is like 8,300 words. I think the Zadie Smith essay would, for us to write about Zadie Smith, we would have to do it in a way that took its own essay at this point. That's the short answer. And then oppositionality.
God, that's such a good question. I mean, I find it like really upsetting. In the editorial debates, I think someone wrote in something like saying, "Must the left always be in opposition?" Do we run that?
Oh yeah, that right. Yeah. I was like,
it's like I'm so tired of this idea that we're in opposition. Must we always?
Yeah, my heart sinks a little when I read that the project of internationalist lit has to be opposition. Why must the left always be in opposition? Let's imagine that there's nothing really to oppose, only a blank slate out of which we may create. I think the historical failure of the left has a lot to do with the way it constantly conceives itself, quote, in opposition.
Yeah, we didn't and take that
you,
edit.
And then you wrote, somebody wrote back, I like opposition, though I understand the concern. Is opposition just left-wing piety? I don't know. well, there's your answer. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think when it comes to the sort of politics of some of the modernists, I mean, and that, you know, that what the caution that we might draw from that, that I think we that I think we find is what is exciting about modernism. Like, and in a way, we identify that some similar oppositions within the literature of decolonizing nation countries. Naipaul on the one side, Gogi on Motiyanko on the other. These sort of figures that we again admire as writers, despite the you could find fault in the politics of one or the other, even if from the left. But so in that sense, the project, like the stance, yeah, I think we do think that is like that's sort of where the essay stops, is that oppositional stance. I think that we do find it a source of aesthetic renewal. I don't know that we necessarily find it a source of political renewal. I think that if we found out that some of the novelists that we admire or publish would have like stances that we disagree with politically, we would be more interested. You disagree, Marco, but that we would be more interested in their work as writers, and that I think that has to do with, you know, challenging pieties on the level of form, on the level of what you think, what on genre. I mean, like these. In fact, it is sort of an aesthetic program, and opposition is what we take from Marxist internationalism. But I think it's more that we feel like this is where the sources of renewal are for a kind of world literature. I mean, you know, if that doesn't sound too mealy-mouthed, probably does.
Well, I think it should be said too that there's, you know, for writers now, this is this moment where, especially in America, increasingly it's considered a career. Kind of, it's a moment of there's this moment of professional anxiety in the writing among novelists that is kind of akin to something that happened among academics in the 80s. It seems like as a rare instance in which academia is ahead of literature. So it's possible to be a writer and very comfortable, and this is always being now something that one hears, and I think a large weirdly, part of the magazine has been that the magazine has been recruited into this writing professional discourse. And we've always been. And what's weird is that from the beginning of the magazine, we were uncomfortable with the university. We were also uncomfortable with writing as a safe profession. And we felt that writing had. So yeah, I mean, I think yeah, you're right that we don't like our friends from college who have become too comfortable in their writerliness, and even though. And we don't like the aspects of ourselves that have become too comfortable in our writerliness, and you know, go to, you know, the American Association of Writers conferences and have a table and talk. You know, that seems like there's this. You know, it's almost. I mean, it's not the Soviet Union where there was a union of writers that enforced a kind of conformity, but there's a kind of professional conformity in writing. And whenever we smell that, we get very nervous. And if we smell that on ourselves, we get nervous. So I mean, if part of our function is to, you know, I mean, it would be great if we had a full bore utopian aesthetic program that we could come here and expound. And like I could bang my shoe on this platform and while expounding my utopian aesthetic platform. But I think for the moment we're like, no, we want to signal the moments when we feel literature is writing is sliding into piety.
Maybe if I can add something to that really important question, is about oppositionality and realism going in fact together in many cases of those new authors we discover or who come from a very different background. Thinking, for instance, Thomas Bernhardt, who was so powerful in Europe a little before he became well-known here, ranting about the Nazi ideology of Austria and so on, which is not very relevant in the US if you read him, whereas still today in Europe it is relevant. There is still a party and so on. And you so there it's similar to the question of realism when you describe something that you have no idea about, a village in Africa or in Indonesia or emerging cultures and so on. And so this is the risk here, that you just somehow appreciate something for the effect of style, missing a little bit what really constituted it as a political force. And what you've described, I think, fairly well, is how even in the cases of strong representationality or oppositionality, the energy gets lost after a while. Yeah. And so this is why I guess your ambition is to keep on discovering new authors.
Right. And there's, I mean, yeah, there's also part of the global lit phenomenon is Americans reading novelists who we think of as persecuted in their own countries, right? So something like, you know, The Kite Runner, which is, you know, not a great novel, but then you're like, oh, but like, you know, what's going to happen to this guy if he stays in Afghanistan, you know, the whole thing, right? And that's, we have a, partly because it's like partly with the Rushdie affair too, right? I mean, that you know, we're like, oh, like Rushdie must be a great writer because the Iranians want to kill him. And you're like, well, actually, is it possible that the Iranians want to kill him for bad reasons, but that this doesn't make him a great writer? And that's, I think, you know, that was something that.
Yeah. Yes, question here.
I just spent a year doing field work in Siberia, and all the young people there are reading a lot of literature translation. It's actually not literature, it's mostly theory, global theory. So I'm kind of wondering about the competition between global literature and global theory. And so my question is, so they're reading, you know, any oppositional young person who wants to, you know, like, goes to Occupy in Novosibirsk, which I think is really cold and really dedicated, or shows up to any, like, minor, you know, public events that are cultural, well, cultural activists will come. They're all reading, you know, art theory, they're reading Hart Negri or Vierno, in translation of Zizek, or, you know, like Berger or Barthes. There's all these new translations of, you know, global theorists. And actually, they're not reading global literature at all. And my question is that because there is no literature that's offering to educate their sentiments, like you're saying, in this oppositional way? There is no. If they want a sentimental education, they cannot turn to literature. Or is it that literature itself has just lost out in this battle of global discourses, and actually urbanism, art, criticism, which, you know, actually right-wing conservative groups in Novosibirsk, kind of like a local art critic, who has his own expertise in the local, you know, art exhibits. But there is basically, that's my question, is global literature just, is literature itself just losing out, or is it that,
as you offer,
there is no literature aiming to educate young oppositional
lions. Huh. Sounds like that's the case in Novosibirsk. I mean, it's a good point. I mean, and interestingly, I mean, Kirill Medvedev, who we talk about a little in the piece, I mean, his thing as a Russian writer, he's like all these theorists of, you know, of the French left and of the international left have now been translated into Russian for the first time in a lot of cases. So he's telling people as an ex-poet or as a poet who considers himself an ex-poet that that's what they should be reading. So I wonder if there's, I mean, I think you're onto something in the Russian case. I wouldn't know if that's true generally.
Well, just from university, like,
Yeah, no, I think this is, I mean,
kind of recalls your too much sociology piece, the diminishing cultural capital of literature and how it's been supplanted in university departments by like an alternative theory canon.
Yeah, I mean, there's you know, even further back, there's this editorial that we published called about theory, just called "Death Is Not the End" from issue 2, which. Mm-hmm. Which suggested this very thing that from 1970 to 1990, Americans just read, they did their thinking through the French and in like through French theories. You know. Yeah, and like and.
But then you say they discontinued the model. And that was very good. The model.
Yeah, yeah. And so that, you know, there was a way in which that, I mean, in a way that theory had a, had the bravura of the avant-garde or of modernism, and also the kind of political salience or urgency, it seemed like, you know. And that, you know, that I think that that's true. I think there's a way in which, I mean, I don't know, I think we see this among some other journals that, that are, friend, you know, comrades of ours, that where literature itself is not this, they write a lot about other cultural studies in a, like a kind of broader sense, but they're, but the materials are, yeah, like autonomous theory, Hart and Negri, and like, you know, that stuff. It has, a, in situations of urgency, or when felt urgency about politics, it may be that that people, that it seems like literature is no longer speaking to that. I mean, in a way, there's a kind of misguided, one of the things we're talking about in the essay is that there's a, there might be a kind of misguided attempt by writers to equal this kind of discourse, to be like, well, no, we're urgent too. Look, we, here's this novel we published that starts in 1945 in Germany and goes to like Japan, and then and all, and like gets the bomb drops on us, and then we go to Delhi in 1947 around partition, and then we go to Afghanistan in 1990. Like, this actually, there is a novel that does this. And
wait, what novel is that?
It's what's it called? It's by Kamla Shamsi. I forget the Burnt Shadows.
Yeah.
It's quite a novel. It's a doozy. And it in that sense, like, there's this attempt to compete with, it's like, no, we have our own globalization theory. And that seems to actually diminish the urgency of that kind of work. I mean, there might be other forces at play that are doing this. It's not just that literature's mucking it up, but I feel that sometimes I'm reading some globalization theory that is more, you know, active, and even necessarily in possibly better written. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, what is the sorrows of young Werther of our age? To go back to Goethe, what is the novel that people are reading and then killing themselves over in 10 different countries? Is there
it's
one?
Empire. That's so sad. much worse.
Any other question? Yes, here.
Okay. Can anybody hear me?
Yeah.
So when I think about this, I think about, you know, world music and how, you know, it was kind of like this great marketing scheme for record companies of the 1990s and New Ageism. But of course, that was kind of the opposite of the not, you know, trauma. It was all about like, oh, if I just listen to this sitar, then it's going to like open me up and I'm going to like feel good and meditate and everything like that. And here we are, you know, over 20 years later, and that's totally died out. You know, New Age really isn't like a force, certainly not a force for making money like it was for record companies back then. But it seems like that's not the case with this other strain in literature. And I just wonder, in the way that music was kind of being prescribed by record labels, and, you know, the kind of, this is like a snake oil salesman is gonna, you know, this is gonna like make you feel better, and that the novel, like dealing with trauma, is prescriptive in its own way, and certainly as like a radical militant activist magazine, you're prescribing something maybe for readers. It seems more for writers, or is it for publishers? And who do you think deserves prescription at this stage?
So your question is who's our audience, sort of? Who are,
well, I assume your audience is us right now.
Indeed.
No, it's kidding.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering. I'm wondering how, why you think that like it hasn't ended the same way there. What makes the literature industry different, and how you see yourselves addressing the industry or addressing the culture.
Yeah, I think the world music analogy is an interesting one that we thought about, and certainly there's, yeah, I mean, part of it is like, that's where the title in certain ways came from, you know, the world light you can imagine like a little Yusu Endur soundtrack to this. In some cases, you know, and largely this was you know, in the music industry, it was like, well, it was very well intentioned. You know, it was how do we get these musicians? How do we get them paid in some cases and get them Western audiences? Is it by working with, is it like working with Paul Simon? Is that what's going to do it? You know, so certainly as far as the audience, like, you know, I mean, we would, I think the admonitions are to everyone, to readers, to writers, and to publishers. And yeah, and publishing is a very, you know, publishers are scared a lot of the times. You know, they think that they have to publish the thing that worked before, you know. It's hard to get publishers to take risks. So.
But it's hard to say that it's, I mean, it does feel successful in this very odd way when you are in, certainly at these literary festivals. I just feel like it's like, you guys gotta go to them. They're crazy. I mean, like they just feel like, you just are like, where is this wealth coming from? Like they just like, the Jaipur Literary Festival, I have not been to that, but one day. It's like, it's extraordinary, like the kind of like celebration of writing, and you're just like, everything's great, literature's doing great, what are we worried about back home, you know, like, and there's a way in which it feels like this, it's either this kind of, this joke on all of us, that it's like, we're like, and then tomorrow, we're all gonna die, or it's that there's a kind, they've figured out, you know, in India in particular, there's like a growth in the publishing industry there. That seems to be, and that there's a growth in the audience, but you know, this also accompanies conditions that we have here, which are just like drastic inequality. And at the same time, it's not stable. I mean, a lot of those authors can't survive on their publishing advances there. They have to, or their journals or whatever, they have to actually publish in the West. I mean, some of the people we mentioned in our article, like Saman Subramanian, and Roy, Arundhati Roy, and Davish Kayeri, like these people have contracts that they get from selling, you know, so like the system is more advanced in that sense. It the world literary system, I think it's more stable, it's less subject to the kind of depredations that have affected the record industry. But it also feels a little bit unhinged. I feel like it's like slightly, there's like something, the elites in those countries have not given up on culture in the way that they are doing in the United States. I mean, that's for better or for worse.
So maybe the Jaipur people heeded your message. It just took place last week, and there was a session with Jonathan Franzen and Jhumpa Lahiri, Jhumpa Lahiri declared that she's only reading in Italian now, and they stress the importance of reading in translation. So that's maybe true. There's hope.
They read us.
Maybe she realized her audience is in Italy.
I'll just ask the question. Fascinating discussion. I have to admit, a lot of it over my head. But I have a kind of a chicken and egg type of question about where you see the root of the concern you have, whether it's in the writing itself, what's being written now, or is it the reception that it's getting, the marketplace, what's being rewarded?
Well, it's a feedback loop of a kind, right? And I think, I mean, we also were, part of what the essay does is it goes, I mean, it's in some ways trying to sketch historical cycles that are even, you know, so that partly, you know, we talk about how, like, the first world literature in certain ways, you know, in the West was, you could say, was the Bible in Latin, which was, of course, available across countries, but only to a very select group of people. And then as it became translated, it became particularized, and this. So then you had this rise of national literatures. And then the question is now, so I think ghosting in the background is, are we headed towards a situation where reading or literature, or, you know, the novel, let's call it, let's just say it's novel, is going to be read by an elite groups in, you know, 50 countries and nowhere else? And is that what is that now the market for literature? Is that how it's constituted? Is that how writers think of themselves? And of course, this becomes self-reinforcing, right? I mean, you can sit around and you can be like, how do I write the next English patient, right? Yeah. As a writer, so or publishers will say, how do I publish the next English patient? Where is that? That's the novel. Like, don't bring me this Mexican guy writing about poor people in Mexico City and their dialogue. Bring me this writer who is crossing oceans and can set a, you know, has six bourgeois characters in 10 different countries, right? And their country houses. So that's the, you know, of course we don't, you know, I wouldn't know how to answer the origin question, but it is a feedback loop. And we, you know, and maybe we put a stop, you know, I mean, who knows, maybe the polemic is able to come in at the side and divert it somehow.
So I guess just part of that question then is, where, in looking ahead, where do you see the movement?
Well, I guess I just sketched a very pessimistic scenario, right, in which it's like, yeah, I mean, maybe literature is, if we keep the term literature rather than, you know, stories that matter, if we are like in this kind of historical cycle where it becomes something for elites in 20 different countries or 30 different countries, that's one possible. That's the pessimistic outcome. I mean, do the optimistic outcome. I'm always curious. I'm good for pessimism, especially as it gets later.
Winter.
I have a question. Wasn't literature usually written by the elite and consumed by the elite? And whatever you advertise doesn't seem like it'll Medvedev, doesn't seem like literature that is written for the masses. We are not looking about the detective genre and about the genre that is received by the masses. And also about like what was asked before about the connection between world literature and world theory. I think like many theorists of world literature, like Pascal Casanova, like Bourdieu, like Jim English, is talking about exactly they are criticize the same criticism that you are talking about the interconnection between cultural capital, social capital, and economic capital. So I was wondering how much your article is informed about those theories.
Can I do the? Just I think there's also, just to do the first part. You know, I think it's a fallacy to say literature has always been written for the elite. I mean, or writing has always been done by an elite. Certainly that was true at a certain point in European history. It became less true. I mean, that was during the 20th century. If we are headed back to that point, that's, I don't think, necessarily a good thing. And in the case of Medvedev, I mean, this is a Russian poet who does write for, I mean, he doesn't ask for copyright on his works. His works are publicly available. You can be, and I think that, I mean, that we reach this point of, if a few people read your work, does that mean you're an elitist or a member of an elite or just somebody who's read by a few people and hope to be read by more people, right? I mean, that's so I would be careful there. But yeah, I mean, you're, yeah, and you want to do
the. And the second part of your question was about the theoretical suppositions and where we're, right, like whether, yeah.
Don't we really agree with Casanova?
Do we really? Yes. No. We rely on. There's like a large body of world literature as a topic is sort of like an old one, and it's sort of coterminous with like comparative literature. And then that's boring. But the we did feel that we followed Casanova to the extent that we felt like. We thought the schema of there being sort of capitals where sort of like world literature was transacted, where the autonomous sphere of world literature was being made, Paris, then London, New York, and now many. We just kind of extended that to some degree. We did feel like, I mean, I think we might be closer to Franco Moretti in the sense that we find it was, you know, inequality that we wanted to measure. We thought there were more material bases to these phenomena. Like, I mean, there's something peculiar about Paris in Casanova's example, that it's, you know, France is not the capital of world capitalism. Like, it's London, you know, why isn't it England? But I think in this case, we did feel like there was a connection between economic elites and world literature and the way it works. I mean, New York, London, like these, like Delhi to some degree, like these places, that are command, what Sassen calls command and control centers of capital. Like, we thought that these didn't just have high levels of symbolic capital. They had money as well, and that I think is part of it. Does that answer that?
But perhaps one can historicize it even more,
yeah,
and say that there was a moment when there was only an elite that slowly was replaced by a broader public, and for me, a book that was an eye-opener when it was published 20 years ago or so, Rancière's Night of Labor, shows very well, yeah, how the uneducated French workers who were on the left could produce texts that were not good, technically speaking. They were terrible, terrible poetry, terrible memoirs, and so on, but very, very interesting in that they expressed the sort of emergence of a different ideology of the workers against the bourgeoisie. And conversely, it brought Rancière to a different theoretical outlook on literature and the sociology or history of literature as such. So I think this is a little in the line of what you are doing, where, you know, we don't have to read just novels. We can read memoirs, documents, and so on. At times more interesting, indeed. But it feeds the machine that brings us to novels as well, I think. I don't know whether that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
You would agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Any more questions?
Last question, yes.
No mic. Is it working? No.
You can do it.
Okay. As Calvino was very aware, our literature comes in certain ways from a pre-literate oral tradition, though much diminished in the West, and it's not just fairy tales. And I remember my grandparents' generation from Italy telling things that I later found out were from the Odyssey and so on, and things that were supposed to be from the Bible, which were never in the Bible, stories, because the peasants made up all kinds of interesting things in their downtime or whatever. This speaks to your elitist question in a way. Did you consider it all Homer is originally some kind of oral, if Homer isn't one of the cornerstones of all Western literature, what is? And so,
right. We're not, you know, this is the, there's world literature in the general sense, right, which is, you know, which you could say is the body of all, you know, poesis, right? I mean, utterances, stories, whether they're oral, whether they're, you know, they're performed. I mean, you know, the essay is just about world literature as a system for dealing with writing and published writing, in particular. I mean, we're not even dealing with unpublished manuscripts, right? But I mean, interestingly, I mean, this, you know, Ben, who is one of the authors of the piece, there was an earlier essay. I mean, Ben is sort of haunted by apocalyptic imaginings, as I think many of us are. And he was kind of like, well, like, what, like, as a novelist, as somebody who's like devoted my life to becoming a writer, you know, what would I do when civilization collapses, which of course is going to happen at any moment, whether because of peak oil or whether because of global warming or because the economy is going to collapse? You know, what will I, you know, when nobody pays me for my writing, what will I do?
Or maybe I no longer even want to be paid for it. Maybe I want to anticipate the collapse of civilization. I would do community theater. Was his answer. So he kind of he was basically like, we should all there should be a revival of community theater, and these small kind of imagine like the strolling players, and so this was a seduction, and I think somewhere you could say that's part of the system. But at that moment you'd be dealing, the idea of world literature is this, this exists because of very sophisticated economies of translation, of scale, of you can publish a book in New York and it can sell in India, or a book can be written in India, published in New York, and then resold in India or sold in London. So we have written about the collapse of civilization, but not in this piece is the answer.
there are. We don't. It's true we don't talk about. Orature, I guess, is like an ugly portmanteau.
Cell phone novels.
We don't talk. Yeah, but we don't. We don't talk about them. But we do. There is like, but we do talk about community theater actually. Like Gogi Wathiongo, who famously had published these increasingly Marxist novels in Kenya, and then was like, these only reach the elites. I can't do this anymore. And I care about, I care about revolution. So I'm going to just produce. He produced a literature that, at least novels, that did not exist in Gikuyu, and went and did community theater in rural areas, and then was imprisoned for his theater. We're not saying that people should go to prison, but this seemed like this amazing exit from the system of world literature. Of course, then these products then did make their way into circulation. Now you can read these plays in translation. But
that would be an instance of international literature, right?
That would be
the international the good international literature would be you do your thing in your community, and people are then become aware of it globally, so they can replicate. They do their own thing in their community. That would be the internationalist form of a rather than saying you have to consume this object. You instead replicate a practice.
So sort of Gramscian model.
Yes.
The organic intellectual.
All right. I'm happy to soak that.
Rather than the campus novel. Okay.
In this case, it might be. Although here, you might have to do a campus novel, or at least a campus campus protest play would be good. I'd like to see a protest play at Penn.
All right, well, that wraps up tonight's discussion. Thank you all so much for coming out to Slot. We really appreciate it. Thank you to our panelists, Nikhil, Marco,
Jean-Michel. Thank you.